I guess there it is.
Something too hard to touch. The human mind can stand so much. You can't win. You're a losing hand. Feel like falling in love with the first world. Putting in a wheelbarrow and wheeling her down the street. People are crazy in times of strain. Nothing tight, matter range. I used to care, but I changed. I heard easy, I just don't show it. You can hurt someone not even knowing. The next 60 seconds could be an eternity. Gonna get low down, gonna fly high. All the truth in the world adds up to one big lie. In love with a woman who don't even appeal to me. Mr. Jinx and Miss Lucy, they jumped in late. I'm not that eager to make that mistake. My people are crazy and times are strange. I'm locked in tight, I'm out of range. I used to care, but things have changed.
Bada bing, bada boom. We'll try this again. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. This is Mike down here in Arizona land. Your mind is your primary weapon. Today is the 24th of September, 2018. It's a Monday, and you're tuned into Liberty Tree Radio. Now, I didn't get a hold of Ted since last week's broadcast, but I know that there's a couple of people out there. Are you there, Ted? Okay, maybe he's not here yet. But I have a contingency plan. Let's see, where are we?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, okay, great, great. I apologize for not calling you. I've been overcome by events these last. But anyway, that's then and this is now. Okay, very good. Give me about 1 minute just to run through a couple of things. My email address is altabeeb762@hotmail.com. altabeeb762@hotmail.com. Thanks for taking the time to tune in today. Also, remember, here on Liberty Tree Radio, having a fun drive to collect enough money for next year's bill. I guess there's some deal worked out. It is if they pay it ahead of time, it cut the price of the bill in half. So we're closing in on the end of the year. So if you find the broadcasts here on Liberty Tree Radio beneficial to you, then please help support Liberty Tree Radio. It's libertytreeradio.4ng.com, and the contact information is all there. As usual, as always, we send this broadcast out to Lily, Grace, Antoinette, and got a couple of other border issues that I'll just mention one. I don't have paperwork in front of me. Kind of something that developed here over the weekend there. About 2 weeks or so ago, there was a head-on crash in a back highway in the state of Arizona, and it killed 8 people. The updated version of it once was that there was an SUV, a Chevy Suburban, headed north on Highway 79, and that it runs from Tucson up a back way up towards the Phoenix Valley. And there was a Buick headed south. They say that the Buick crossed the center line, head-on collision, and the driver and the passenger in Buick were killed on contact. The same happened in the Suburban, but also in the back of the Suburban, there were a number of Guatemalan illegal aliens, and a number of them. So with the driver and the passenger in both the vehicles, that's 4 plus 4 more were killed. And I noticed that most of the information is just contained in the state of Arizona news, Fox News and the Arizona Republic and those places. Chances are nobody's that doesn't live in Arizona hasn't heard about it. So I just find that it's just odd, once again, that you've got this big, giant, catastrophic crash that kills 8 people and nary a peep, and it has to do with the issue about the border. Well, anyway, enough of that said. I'll try to get to that information when we broadcast over on the Micro Effect on Thursday and Friday. But anyway, without any further ado, last week we had broadcast the interview with Ted Midward. His contact information is, I think it's tedmidward.info. And I guess he had been listening, longtime listener of the Micro Effect, or Liberty Tree Radio, and had been listening to the Intel report with Mark and Don, and had left his device on and stumbled across Your Mind is Your Primary Weapon and found it interesting and beneficial to him. So we've emailed and telephoned back and forth a number of times over the last, I guess, maybe a year by now. And Ted has got a podcast that you can get there on tedmidward.info, contact information and things like that. It talks about similar things that were going on here. He had an interesting concept that we live all in our own little bubble, so we don't know other things, and there could be people that might be our next door neighbor or somebody else at work, but because we've been told over the years that, oh, you're crazy, oh, you're this, oh, no, nobody thinks about those things, that couldn't possibly be happening. That's part of the psychological psy war ops that's being run on us right now that make you think that you're out here in left field and you're the only person in the world and you must be crazy to think about those things. But Ted has come to the realization that, you know, we all have our ponds of people that think the way that we do and listen to the broadcast, but the powers that be are so effective in convincing us that we're just all by ourselves out here and nobody thinks in those directions, that all we need to do is help reach out, whether it's with Ted's broadcast or with Liberty Tree Radio or the Micro Effect, and then we start to realize that we're not alone and that we are effective in what we're doing, but we just need to introduce this people in Pond A to the people in Pond C, and maybe there might be a C, D, E, F, G, H out there, and that's one of the big problems that we have in this patriot movement, that we've got this pond effect as to where nobody knows nobody else, and it might be your next-door neighbor, a coworker, somebody at church, or somebody in the checkout line at the grocery store. Is that kind of sum it up, Ted?
Yes, that's very accurate.
Okay, good. Well, welcome here to Your Mind is Your Primary Weapon. I really enjoy discussing these things with you. Seem to have a lot of insightful information about these things that we discuss here.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me. I appreciate the invitation. It's great to get a chance to talk to you again.
Good. Yeah. I don't know. It just since last week's broadcast, it's just turned into a big Sierra sandwich, and I'm having to choke the whole thing down. And it's just, you know how it is. That's, everything was going fine until life got in the way. Now, when I had spoke to you back, a couple, 3 weeks ago, that you had said that you had some questions to ask. And now last week we had covered a lot about General Lansdale. He kind of touched a little bit about the events of history, how they tie in with the current events, and discussed a little bit about the book, The Art of Insurgency. And let's see what else. We talked about your contact information, the podcast. And we also talked about choice or decision architecture and the options on how the part of psychological warfare of to where you see you would go into a store and there were a whole bunch of, you know, brands of pickles or mustard or spaghetti sauce, and sometimes people would just get overwhelmed with the amount of choices, decisions they had, and the manufacturers hired marketers to look at their product and came to the realization that it wasn't that there weren't enough choices to buy this type of spaghetti sauce, but actually it was too many choices. So they cut down, instead of having 15 different brands of spaghetti sauce, they cut it down to 3, and now their sales went through the roof because that's that part of it. So if wherever you'd like to jump in, if you want to follow up on any of these things or branch off into something else, feel free.
Sure. I'll tell you that since last week, I've gotten about 75 to 80% of the way through the Hamilton book. And I know we mentioned it briefly last week, that book in particular. So it was the first couple chapters are a little dry and detailed, and I like to take my time and try to highlight and underline some of the more important points. And it quoted several different thinkers about what insurgency is and what it isn't. And I found that after I got past the first couple of chapters, it got really interesting. It was a little bit more historical. It went into General Lansdale's backgrounds and what he was doing in the Philippines, and then later when he was sent to South Vietnam. So I'm a good deal of the way through the book, almost finished. There was a couple concepts at the beginning of the book, the first couple chapters, that still a little murky. And the main one is primary insurgency versus secondary insurgency. If you could maybe give me an example of each or try to clear that up, that's one thing that it seemed a little vague when they were describing it in the book. I'm not sure what the difference is.
Okay. Let me think about this second. It's interesting that just to collaborate what you were talking about, when I had first read the book, I was just my eyes glazed over. being that my military background generally had to do with, you know, conventional war, you know, artillery, armor, attack helicopters, Air Force bombers type of stuff like that. And when I stumbled on this part of about insurgency, it was like, what are these guys talking about? And I had read through the book.
A lot of terms that aren't really familiar to most people, and this is, you know, the subject of your show is something that just, it's counterintuitive to most people, and I think that's why it's so valuable, and I want to know more about it, but I've got it pulled up to the page. On page 27, they talk about a primary or a secondary course of strategy, and it says, primary insurgency seeks military victory by maintaining pressure through guerrilla operations but avoiding any major set-piece battle with government forces, whereas secondary seeks victory by way of changing from isolated or purely guerrilla operations to what Mao Zedong referred to as a war of movement. And, I mean, I take it that secondary is more of going head-to-head and trying to have traditional military engagements with the enemy, but I didn't know about the order. I think about the war in Vietnam, and that's probably the example I'm probably most familiar with. And I know that Jop wanted to – I know there's three stages, right? The first stage, you kind of take it slow and sit back and choose the battle when you want to – on your own terms. You basically choose when and where to fight. But there were engagements at the beginning of Vietnam pretty early on, like in the Yadrang Valley, where I think it was Jop or one of the other commanders. They went head-to-head, you know, in, what, 65 or 66 on that mountainside in the Yadrang Valley. So I wasn't sure how primary and secondary kind of fits in. And I know you want to take it step by step. You don't want to go full throttle and get in a head-to-head battle in the first stage of the insurgency, right?
Correct. Well, because usually the insurgents know it's going to be protracted because it's designed to wear the government out and fatigue the people of supporting the war. And you'll take a look at a lot of these insurgencies and the post-World War II, and oftentimes they've taken 10 years. But you see, initially, when the insurgents start off, they have an idea. They've got a cause. They have a complaint about the legitimacy of the government. And it's just a bunch of peasants that may have a rifle and a water bottle, and that's pretty much it. And then this division from primary to secondary insurgency, as the insurgent forces, you know, through ambushing and raids on small outposts, they start to acquire more sophisticated military. Instead of just having a rifle or a shotgun, they might get armored vehicles or machine guns, mortars and things, and then to get the people trained to do that, or to be able to use those systems. And then as they start to acquire more people and more sophisticated weaponry, then they actually become more of what we perceive as a conventional force. You mentioned the deal of about what was going on in North Vietnam that, you know, there's a long history of it going on, you know, even before the United States involvement, especially in the early 30s with pre-World War II, as to where they were, you know, started manufacturing weapons on their own up in North Vietnam in the Red River Valley. And then during World War II, the OSS parachuted a deer team into North Vietnam to work with Ho Chi Minh and General Giap. and, you know, supply them with radios and weaponry, ammunition, small unit tactics type of a deal, and it built them up. And so then when the World War II ended, then the French thought it was just going to be back to business as usual. And at that point, the Vietnamese had pretty much acquired enough weaponry as to where, and there was a lot of it that, as I understand, was American weaponry that had been captured in Korea when, in 1950, when the North Koreans invaded South Korea, the weaponry, artillery pieces and everything that were disassembled and moved up into China and then down either by rail or truck or roads or however that was, down into Vietnam. And then when the French thought that they were going to, the Vietnamese, the Viet Minh had, they were moving forward to get into this more of a conventional type of fighting, and they had gone up into the hills surrounding Dien Bien Phu and dug, you know, caves back in the mountainside to conceal these artillery pieces, and a lot of it had had to be disassembled and moved by manpower up the sides of these hills. So that kind of discusses this part of about moving from just a ragtag insurgent group up to actually employing, you know, conventional military weaponry and tactics as to where the French thought that they were going to lure them out, but actually the French were a sitting target because of their surrounding hills that where this artillery was. The, like you said, the primary insurgency, they want the military victory because they're going to maintain the pressure through guerrilla operations, and then they're going to avoid any major set-piece battle with the government. And that's the to wear down the government through a protracted conflict. And that's going to rely upon isolated fights at the guerrilla's own choice of place and time. And the secondary seeks victory from changing from the isolated or purely guerrilla operations into a more of a conventional setting type of a deal. Now, there's, you know, we talk about examples. We just gave the one as to where the primary versus secondary on what happened with the Viet Minh fighting the French and eventually what they kind of did in against the Americans. And also there was all that stuff about after the United States left, there was the part of about Cambodia and China and any and those issues. Another example about this primary versus secondary insurgency could be General Grievous on the island of Cyprus that went purely guerrilla tactics, never had a whole bunch of people, and just kept pressure through these isolated bombings and attacks on the government of Cyprus to eventually drive them out. Does that make sense? I guess also with Fidel Castro, because until like right at the very end, they never had any more than like 150 people. But then all of a sudden when it looked like they were going to win, that all of a sudden everybody wanted to be a part of the revolution, and they pretty much stuck with the primary insurgency, just avoiding any military set-piece battles and sticking just with guerrilla operations. Is
okay,
that up?
Yeah, that makes more sense. They didn't provide any solid examples in the book, and it I think it helps me to look at an historical example along with what they're trying to describe. Let me just say that, you know, I didn't live through Vietnam. I'm of the millennial generation, and as I've made a serious study of this war over the past, it's got to be over a year, and I've read a couple books about it and watched numerous documentaries on YouTube, and I just cannot help but be, and I don't want to come across as un-American or somehow against the veterans. Lord knows that's not where I'm going with this. But I cannot help but be totally awed, totally impressed by North Vietnamese leadership. It seems like they played their cards perfectly. And it seems like LBJ played them totally the opposite. Like he seemed motivated by all the wrong reasons. He tried to get Westmoreland out there and win this war in 3 years so that when re-election time rolled around, he'd look like some hero. One of the other dynamics that I read about that really impressed me, it's counterintuitive to the way most Americans think. The North Vietnamese leadership, they understood that they had to have congruence or some equality between the political aims, the diplomatic aims, and their military aims. There couldn't be any contradictions in what they were trying to accomplish with all three of those. And you see that on the American side, we had more or less Lyndon Johnson, his motivations, his aims, and his cabinet. And then you had the Westmoreland more or less tasked with trying to win this war and be a puppet of Lyndon Johnson, which, as I understand it, that's a huge no-no. You cannot micromanage your generals and expect to win a war. You have to let them wage the war according to the conditions on the ground, and you more or less have to be removed from it. And I more or less have come to learn that waging a foreign war like Empire America has done over the past 70 years, it's not possible for democracies to win these wars, because the politicians are ultimately beholden to the voters, and the voters eventually tire of fighting these wars for nothing, for no tangible benefit that the average person can see. So those are just my, I guess, initial observations. I cannot help but be totally impressed by these people. And I guess you can say the same with Mao Zedong in Korea too, right? I'm totally blown away.
Exactly. No, it's the classic example of what a motivated people can do. Once they've had it, and they're not going to take it anymore, and they'll, like that Jackson Brown, his governments do these things to the people, and people can't take it anymore until they pick up a gun or a brick or a stone, and that's kind of the whole deal. But yes, I agree. You know, when we start down this path of about Vietnam, and you know, it can really conjure up a lot of emotions. And you cannot blame the individual soldiers that were doing what they were ordered to do. I think, in my opinion, that what happened in Vietnam, that half of the people were trying to wage a war against the insurgents, and the other half of the military was trying to fight a conventional war, and it was like they got the sequence, the steps out of order. I've seen an overlap of the development of the Viet Minh / Viet Cong and the overlap of the development of the U.S. involvement. And this ties back into what we discuss about the primary versus secondary insurgency. So if you look a starting point would be maybe the mid-30s or the early 40s, that the guerrilla tactics that they start off. And what we're doing is kind of looking at two humps, like on the back of a camel. So as the insurgency starts off, it gains momentum, it gains weapons, it gains people, it gets a cause, people start to rally around it. And then as you come over the top of the hump, then it intersects with the next hump going up, and that would be the transition from a purely guerrilla or an insurgent war as to where you've acquired these weapons, and then you're taking a portion of your guerrilla forces and transitioning them into a more of a, it would go from like a Viet Cong or a Viet Minh over into a North Vietnamese army. And then that hump goes along. Now, the second and the overlapping curves, again, it's like two humps on the back of a camel. And when we examine these at the dates and the general trajectory of how the U.S. developed, because initially, President Ngo was fighting the Viet Cong on guerrilla tactics, because we always have to bear in mind that the guerrillas have the upper hand. They get to choose when and where to fight. And so if they're choosing when and where to fight, then you have to match their tactics. You can't fight guerrillas with a sledgehammer. You're going to have to go out and, you know, as the old adage is you can't kill your way out of an insurgency. But as this started to develop post-World War II, and bear in mind once again that the U.S. had supported Ho Chi Minh by parachuting the OSS team in there to help them fight the Japanese. So they had already, the Viet Minh or the Viet Cong had already moved from phase one of the insurgency, the political subversion aspect, into the open guerrilla warfare. But then somehow somebody started thinking that what the South Vietnamese need to do is make a mirror image of the United States military. So that means forget about this counter-guerrilla stuff, and you need to buy tanks and armored personnel carriers and helicopters and patrol boats and all kinds of Navy vessels and airplanes and bombers and stuff, and you need to, the only way you're going to get these guerrillas is by making a mirror image. So then when we take these overlapping bell curves or the humps on a two-hump camel and overlap them with the, and it's surprising how closely they coincide with the development of the insurgents on the Viet Cong, the Viet Minh side, and then their transition to a more of a set-piece military. And so when the president of South Vietnam was fairly effectively fighting these guerrillas on the guerrillas' terms, and then we stepped in and had to sell them all this stuff. So as then we see this bell curve take off and overlapping the time frame of when the guerrillas are developing, and then somewhere when we reach that peak or plateau over the top of the hump and start down, when the guerrillas were transitioning into more of a conventional structure, then the U.S. came along and goes, oh, well, maybe we're trying this the wrong way, and we need to develop these strategic hamlets, and we need to go out here and develop more guerrilla fighters to fight these guerrillas, at almost at the exact same time when General Ziap was transitioning to a conventional, where we had started off with the conventional and then came to the realization that we should go more guerrilla. And it's Keystone Cop stuff. And there's also, just as a, there is supporting evidence that the North Vietnamese with the Viet Cong, the Viet Minh, was not really what you would classify as an insurgency. By the government statistics in South Vietnam, it points out that basically only 1% of the population of South Vietnam really supported what the North was doing. So it really wouldn't classify as a people's uprising, even though that we oftentimes use the term an insurgency, that it was basically just a small group of ruthless people that were bound and determined to take over the government of South Vietnam. So, what say you, Ted?
Well, like I said, I just am in total awe of how united and purposed that they were. And the point about only 1% of them, that's it's shocking. But at the same time, you know, this the Leninist or Marxist rhetoric that they try to use to get people pumped up and committed to the cause, to where it just all of a sudden inspires some organic uprising by the people. I don't know how realistic that is, but again, I couldn't help but be impressed by the, and I think Henry Kissinger and American officials, they tried to call it brainwashing. They couldn't break through the brainwashing. They couldn't, American forces couldn't go on and pacify these people into putting down their weapons. And one thing that stuck out to me watching one of these documentaries, it was that these teenage boys, they would get tattooed on their arm or on their chest somewhere, born in the North to die in the South. The political indoctrination, the conviction that the political officer corps in the Viet Cong was able to imbue in the rest of these lower-level fighters was incredible to me. That's something that you just don't see. And when you draft American boys to go over there and you force them to commit to 12 or 13 months of risking their life every day, they're not over there to fight to win the war. They're over there to survive every day as best they can and to get home as soon as possible. And whoever's ready in a mental or emotional state to tap out at any moment or to give up is eventually going to lose, given enough time.
You bet. You've almost convinced yourself that, you know, it's in the losing proposition. It's kind of like almost playing a card game. Then you've got some real poor hands. So it's like, are we going to play these or are we just going to fold?
Right, right. Well, and you know what? That leads into a bigger point that it didn't hit me at first. I wasn't thinking this was going to be the point, but my study of this war really drove home the point. And I read, someone wrote this explicitly, you know, wars are not won on the battlefield. Wars are won when one side decides to give up the fight. They're won and lost politically. And it was lost at home by the Americans. I think it was when the Tet Offensive happened, support for the war went from 80% in America down to 40%. So the American public got rattled and lost the stomach, the will to continue the fight. And that, I think, was a big nail in the coffin. And that Tet Offensive really, really surprised, I think, Westmoreland and LBJ more specifically.
Mm-hmm. There was also the part of about the reporting that was come from there that, you know, Walter Cronkite comes on and says it's a stalemate. And it's funny how his words, when he left Vietnam, then he was it wasn't a live broadcast, but it was filmed kind of like what he was going to say on the evening news the next night when he got from Hawaii to Broadcast Central, wherever, Los Angeles or New York. And he had said things completely differently of what actually he said on the live broadcast and how the terminology was changed on the telling the truth, because the Tet Offensive, I guess this is one of those examples when we talk about primary and secondary. There was a number of times the Viet Minh, Viet Cong had tried to transition to it back in the, like, 1956, 58, 59, two or three separate times there. And then this other part is to where they had tried it again, and they were just basically annihilated. But somehow they were able to recover from that, and this is another deal of the stuff that was going on with the Tet Offensive, that it pretty much ended the effectiveness of the Viet Cong, and we see them being removed as a fighting force. And then after that, a lot of the infiltration was coming from the North Vietnamese Army, the NVA, at that point. But yeah, it's interesting when they try to make these transitions from the purely guerrilla into a more of a conventionalist, to where they're going to not just sit here and sit by some side of a road and plant a bomb and ambush a convoy going by, that they're actually going to go in here and try to take over major cities and stuff, of what's going on with that part. Now, they did do some things, like the city of Wei, the ancient capital, and I think they held on to that for about a month, but pretty much there was reporting of about that they had taken over the U.S. embassy, and, you know, they had gotten on the grounds with some sappers, but they never did a whole lot of nothing in Saigon itself. They were pretty much wiped out. But yeah, it seems to be, when you mention this stuff about the losing it on the home front, or the political aspect, and that's the part of about insurgency, because that it's the political subversives that matter the most. It's not the guerrillas. And oftentimes, when a government is faced with an insurgency, first off, they don't even realize it until the guerrillas or the insurgents are moving from phase one into phase two, an open guerrilla uprising. They miss the whole political subversive organization aspect of it. And so the government is already one step behind fighting the insurgents, and then they usually make the big mistake of trying to attack the guerrillas themselves, and it's not the primary target, because the primary target are the political subversives. Because even if a government wipes out every guerrilla and leaves the political subversives, they're just going to reconstitute the guerrilla force, and they can oftentimes go on and win. Does that make sense?
Yes. And that brings up another sort of set of questions that I had for you. I read this in the James Warren GIOP book. I think I know a pretty good – let me put it this way. I know much more about the LBJ years of the war than I do the Nixon years. And I wanted to ask you, it seemed like reading that book that some of those Operation Linebacker bombing campaigns, they seemed like they were successful in bringing the North Vietnamese to the negotiating table. I wanted to ask you, do you think Creighton Abrams, the general under Nixon, and Nixon himself, do you think – I know they were. The war was. Was it lost at that point? I don't know if that's a fair statement. It seems like it. Do you think that Nixon and Abrams handled it any better than Westmoreland and Lyndon Johnson did?
Well, they did pretty much bomb them into submission, and they went to Paris and signed a peace accord. And the North Vietnamese admitted that they were defeated. And that's that, but I don't know. I'm still up in the air about this. Once again, back to the basic, you cannot kill your way out of an insurgency. And, you know, bombing Hanoi and only strengthens the will of the people to resist that much more. Now, if we look at other examples of this, you know, what are we going to do? Let's bomb them back to the Stone Age. You know, look at what Hitler did during the Blitzkrieg and firing the V-1s and V-2 missiles into London, then that just strengthened the people's will to resist. But almost at the, well, not at the same time, but during World War II, the United States firebombed Tokyo, Yokohama, and killed 100,000 people in those attacks. The United States firebombed Dresden, and again, those were purely civilian targets and really had no military significance in them, but the thought process was that if we make life difficult for the civilian population, they'll bring pressure on their political leaders to stop all this. So those are, you know, couple of different examples on this application of firepower, whether it's Linebacker, Rolling Thunder, Dresden, firebombing in Yokohama, the Blitzkrieg in the battle for London or whatever that they term that, with the Spitfires and the Messerschmitts and the V1s and V2s. So it's basically the same thought process, but and now we can look at what's going on, say, for instance, in, you know, Iraq or Afghanistan, that the people that had gone over there with the proper mindset, like General Petraeus, that realizing that the people are the strategic terrain, and if we get the support of the people, then this job's going to be a lot easier. But then there's other people, because they've been steeped in, you know, the proper application of high explosives, that somehow they think that they have the right solution to it. So, and now we can see what's happened, to how this is the same thought processes, the same tactics, techniques, and procedures that were applied in World War II, that were applied in Vietnam, and now they're being applied in Iraq and Afghanistan. And, it's kind of like doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result. Does that make sense?
Yes, yes. You were talking about Hiroshima and Nagasaki. From what I've read, that seems like it could qualify as an example of psych warfare, right? I remember reading that the people who wanted to take that action, they knew it wasn't militarily necessary, but they wanted to make a statement on the world stage, from what one source that I remember reading about it. That's one take. And I think that is like the Tet Offensive, right? It wasn't so much the military necessity or that it was viable or going to work on the battlefield. It was the message, the sucker punch message that it sent, that we're still here, we're bigger, stronger than ever, and think twice about messing with us.
Correct. And get them to submit through bringing pressure on. So then I guess then that asks the big question of why in the case with Germany bombing London only strengthened the people's resolve, but then we get these other examples where we do it to them, and then we get the quote-unquote desired effect. The civilian population brings pressure on it, and the psychological warfare aspect of, you know, my bomb's bigger than your bomb type of a deal. But no, when I had made those references, I wasn't including the atomic bomb attacks on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. There were actual firebombings of Tokyo and Yokohama that had actually killed more people than the two atomic attacks. And those happened before those.
I see.
And it's funny, though, as just as a sideline in history, that we frequently hear about the atomic bombs, but we never hear that, I don't know, those, as was it like 80,000 or 100,000 people burnt to death in the bombing of Dresden and Yokohama and Tokyo, and it was a much smaller number that had died during the atomic bomb attacks.
Right. Now, that approach, that would fall under the von Clausewitz total war approach, right? Kind of like with General Sherman burning down Atlanta. It's more or less trying to make the people supporting the enemy submit, right, and give up.
Correct. Because, you see, but when we use our bar graph method, you've got the government at one extreme, the insurgents at the other extreme, and they're both, the government and the insurgents are competing for the support of the people.
Right.
And then,
right.
This kind of goes back to that, this new concept of about what they refer to as enemy-centric or population-centric counterinsurgency. And, boy, I don't know, strange thing. How they use the same methods in one place and it works, and the other method that only it doesn't work. So,
well, it seems to me too that the U.S. is no longer the Republic of the Founding Fathers' day. It is an empire, and it inherited empire status, I think, at the end of World War II with Britain, more or less, the British Empire dying off and France losing ground. And it seems like, well, even the money changers, they kind of used the USA empire to be the next protector of their financial interests. And you kind of sit back and wonder, well, gee, why does the United States make so many mistakes? Why don't they learn from their mistakes, especially in warfare? And then it kind of dawned on me, this is just typical empire behavior. The empire does not act rationally because it's not controlled by rational people. We see politicians, but kind of like the general, they're beholden to the generals seem to be beholden to the president or the politicians or the cabinet setting the policy, and politicians are ultimately responsible or subject to the people who fund them and support them, the special interests that more or less control the empire. So I don't know. Maybe the U.S. military has gotten wise and put smarter, more disciplined people in charge of these wars overseas. But I don't know if that's the case. Do you think we're fighting more effectively in Iraq, Afghanistan, and these other countries around the world than we were 50, 60 years ago in Southeast Asia?
In certain places, yes, we are. As an example, we mentioned it earlier about General Petraeus, because when he was at West Point, he had written his thesis on, well, what we call nowadays insurgency, and to understanding that part of it. So he had been steeped in that direction even before the invasion of Iraq. And then, but there were other people, and what was that guy's name? Wasn't he the Secretary of the Army or the General of the Army? What's that bald-headed guy that, you know, he was kind of like, just kill them all, let God sort them out, and you know, just going in here and we'll just stick with the enemy-centric counterinsurgency. And it even goes further, because when Petraeus led the initial invasion up to Baghdad, and then he was shifted further north up towards the border with Syria and instituted the soldiers living with the people and protecting the people, and oh, they got bulldozers and built big berms around the cities, and patrolled the perimeter, got the people involved because it was their city. They had skin in the game to protect them and keep them separate from the insurgents. They were very effective, and the insurgency never developed there. But the people that wanted to run around Baghdad with tanks and tearing down statues and blowing things up and all that aspect of it, then the insurgency blew up in their face. And then it took them a whole year of arguing back and forth was, well, how are we going to, they wouldn't even admit that it was an insurgency, and they were too busy trying to develop tactics and weapons to fight the insurgents, but they weren't even willing to admit that it was an insurgency in the first place. They were too busy arguing on the proper application of firepower on how to get to these people. And so, you know, it's, I can say that in certain places in Iraq and Afghanistan, they are effectively fighting the insurgents, and in other places they aren't. We heard, you know, several years ago of about, oh, we just need to go over and carpet bomb those places and just leave. And once again, it's people commenting about things that they really don't even grasp. But anything that you'd like to say? I see we're up at the minute. We've got about 2 or 3 minutes in it to wrap this thing up. Ted, you're going to have to come back again.
Well, hey, I appreciate the opportunity to come on here and ask you some questions and discuss some of these concepts. I hope listeners enjoy it and find it interesting too. But thank you for the invitation. I agree with the sentiment. We need to get back together and do it again sometime in the not-too-distant future. Thank you for having me on, Mike. I appreciate it.
Hey, God bless you, Ted. It's always good here. You're welcome here anytime. You want to come back next week, or we'll give it a break for a couple of weeks. And it seems like we have kind of an idea of where we're going to go, and then there's the X factor as to where when we actually get going, and pretty soon we're talking about two humped camels in Afghanistan and making connections between the Blitzkrieg in London and the firebombing of Tokyo, and it's like, wow, how did we get there, you know what I mean?
Yes, I know. It's always exciting.
You bet. Wow, we talking about Lansdale. You're talking about, oh, that book that Ted had mentioned at the beginning is called The Art of Insurgency by Donald W. Hamilton. When I got my copy, they were about $100, but I think Ted found one on the internet, and he got it for $12 total with the shipping. It's an interesting book. The first time you read it, your eyes are going to glaze over. Set it back on the shelf, think about it for a little while, and then get it back down, maybe review a chapter here and there, and it'll all start to make a little bit more sense, but it can be rather difficult. Well, sounds like the music's here, the end of the broadcast. Thanks for taking the time to tune in today and send this one out to Lily Grace Antoinette. And tell your friends about Liberty Tree Radio and the Micro Effect. Later.
Hey, I'm out of range. Gentlemen, I'm only passing through.
been walking 40 miles of bad road. The Bible is right, the world will explode. I've been trying to get as far away from myself as I can. Some days are too hard to touch. The human mind can only stand so much. You can't win, you're a losing hand. Feel like falling in love with the first world I see. Putting in a wheelbarrow and wheeling her down the street. You're on a crazy in time to train. Up and tight, my rain.
That ego.